Sounds fine. I'm Heather Moran, I'm 45, and today's date is Friday, May 9th, 2014. I'm here at the Camden Public Library with Jim Wadsworth, and he's a longtime library patron, and we're getting to know him today.
And I'm Jim Wadsworth, I'm age 61. Today's May 9th, we're at the Camden Public Library, and I've known Heather for a little while from her work in the Ancestry Department upstairs.
So, Jim, what would you like to talk about with us today?
Well, I'd like to talk to you about my career in the sea urchin industry, and it's over now, but it was a wild ride, and it's an interesting story.
It sounds exciting. Tell us all about it.
Well, back in 1989, I grew up in Camden. My parents both grew up in Camden, and I was working in the insurance business. My dad owned an agency here, which he sold to another agency, and I went to work for them, and I wasn't really enjoying it, and I was looking for something else to do, and there was a lot of buzz about the urchin industry, which was just getting started at the time, and mostly down in the Portland area, and I decided I wanted to get involved, so I quit the job at the insurance agency, and my parents were aghast, and they thought I was crazy, and I located a guy down in Friendship, Maine, who's nearby, and he was already buying sea urchins, and we got together and decided we'd become partners.
Had you ever done anything with the urchin industry before?
No.
This is just a spur of the moment?
No experience in the seafood business whatsoever. A lot of the people that started out in the urchin business weren't seafood people at all. They were carpenters, and we had to go out and train these guys how to dive. It was expensive. We had to outfit them, a lot of them, with dive gear too, before they could get in the water, of course. And nobody had any idea what they were doing. Basically, it was learn as you go type of thing. Mm-hmm. Mark knew a little bit. My partner Mark Crockett, and so we moved into his brother-in-law's garage down in Friendship and set up a little packing operation, and we started buying urchins from some of the fishermen down in Friendship and some of the guys that we had lined up to do the diving. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they got down on the ocean bottom and they were amazed at all the urchins down there. And that was, the idea was that go down and pick them all up and bring them back. And they had bags that they would fill and hook to a buoy. And the guy on the boat would bring them up, just like a lobster trap almost. And
Did you have to select just a certain size of urchin?
At that time, you could... They just raked them
right in with their hands
or their rakes or whatever. There were no regulations whatsoever in the beginning. And the whole thing was really the impetus for the fishery was the fact that the lobstermen wanted them gone, which a lot of people don't know.
Why is that?
They were getting in lobster traps. They were making it really difficult for lobstermen to catch lobsters.
Oh, I see.
And they had built up to such an extent that their favorite food is kelp, and they had eaten all the kelp. It was called an urchin baron, a state on the bottom of the ocean where it was just urchins everywhere. Some of them were 3 feet deep in places, and they'd eaten all the kelp. They were starving to death. And it was not a good biological. There was no biological diversity there. It was just urchins. Part of the reason why the lobstermen didn't like it.
That makes sense.
So it turned out that all these urchins weren't very good quality. They didn't have any roe in them because they hadn't been eating anything, and the roe was what was valuable.
I see.
When you crack open an urchin, there are five little pieces of roe in each one, and we'd crack these open, and there'd hardly be anything in them. Hmm. So, we were only paying 10, 20, 30 cents a pound for them, so... that's why, because the Japanese explained to us, well, these aren't really any good, but they realized that we had to get rid of them before they'd get better. And so the hunt became one of finding the places, the ledges, really, around islands and submerged ledges off the coast where there was still some kelp on top of a lot of these ledges, and these urchin fronts would march to these ledges and just crawl up the sides, and when they got to some kelp, they would feed on it. So eventually the divers realized that, well, those are the ones that we want to harvest because they might have some roe in them. And you could tell if they'd been there for a little while and they'd been eating and they hadn't just arrived. And then below them, down into deep water, were all these other urchins waiting to get their chance. It was kind of like a conveyor belt type of...
It's quite an image that you present of like an urchin army marching up the ledges.
That's what it was like. And, it was, for the divers, it was like... amazing, and they were sharp too, and so a lot of them would be sitting on the bottom, and all of a sudden a spine would penetrate their wetsuits and dry suits, and so they had to be careful, and it was dangerous. A lot of these guys, we did have a number of people drowned.
Oh my gosh!
None of my divers, fortunately, but we had, I bet, 5 or 10 drownings in the early years, and be it from panicking,
mm-hmm.
losing their regulators, weather issues. A lot of times, guys would go offshore and load their boat, and then on the way home, it often starts blowing in mid-afternoon, and they'd be like in these small boats a lot of times, and they'd sink or have to throw their urchins over the side or whatever, and there were a lot of Coast Guard rescues.
Oh my gosh.
But there were also some fatalities, so.
So dangerous business.
It was dangerous, and they were landing large quantities. The common container was the fish tote, which you may be familiar with. Mm-hmm. It holds about 100 pounds of urchins, they were filling 10, 20, 30, 40 of those in a day, which is a lot of product.
That's amazing.
And so just the physical aspect of the business was tough, not only for the divers, but for the guy on the boat, the guy at the wharf that unloaded them. And, we had to use these winches to get them off the boat onto the wharf and then into a truck, and it was brutal. So there were, the business really started in the Portland area down in Casco Bay, because there was a guy named Lloyd Covens who was really the first big buyer, and he had come here from California. He was a diver himself. He was also a magician, and he was a crazy guy. And, he recognized the fact that, wow, there's a lot of potential here, because he'd done it in California. Sure. And there was a fishery in California. And he could tell, he knew what a good urchin was, and he knew that Maine had good bottom and a great resource. So he got going, and he was the main buyer back in the early years. And he actually had a couple of boats of his own, and he had his own divers that he paid. I think he paid them by the hour in some cases, but anyway... they cleaned up Casco Bay, and they said, well, what are we going to do now? And they started moving this way. Eventually, all the way to Eastport and Lubeck. But that took a few years.
Sure.
So at the time I started, I started a couple years after he did, and Mark and I centered the operations around Friendship and Rockland, and we did pretty well. I went to Japan four or five times to try to line up the right market, and I was lucky enough to find a guy in Sapporo in Hokkaido, Japan, and they wanted to try it, and they had relationships with the processors in Hokkaido, which is where most of the Japanese processors were located. So I went over there and developed a relationship, and they got comfortable with me, and they started buying our product. And, after a few so-so shipments, we started to get the hang of it, and I did the quality control in the plant, and Mark, we bought a lobster boat. He took a few divers out, and we bought from other boats, and we started to become a player. Mm-hmm.
So was this sort of a new delicacy in Japan?
No, it was a traditional delicacy.
I see.
But they had fished their resource out, so they were looking around the world for a good place to buy urchins. And we were lucky enough to have it at the right time. The timing was perfect. And even though it took a while to get rid of the bad urchins and teach people how to get a good urchin, we were in the right place at the right time. And the key was that our urchin was almost identical to the Japanese urchin. And they were ripe, so to speak, at the right time of the year, which is when the New Year holiday in Japan, and the whole business is driven by Japanese holidays because it's a traditional holiday treat in Japan. And it's also, one of the healthiest things you can eat because they're feeding on kelp. And, of course, the Japanese consider it an aphrodisiac as well as a great tasting sushi. It's one of the most expensive sushis in Japan. So as these things often go, Mark and I didn't always agree on how to grow the business, and he wanted to become a processor. At that time, everybody that was in the urchin business was shipping the whole urchin in a styrofoam box with ice on them, and it was a limited market at that time. So everybody in Maine wanted to make it bigger, of course, and the only way to do that was to start cracking them open and scooping the roe out over here and opening a processing plant. And a lot of people started doing that, and several of them were Japanese who knew what they were doing.
Sure.
And had done it in other parts of the world. So Mark wanted to do that, and I thought, wow, I don't like the idea of hiring 100 Orientals to work in Rockland here. I think I'd rather just stay with the live market and do that and do it well. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not what he wanted to hear, and so he started looking around for other investors and partners, and to make a long story short, we ended up on opposite sides of the fence, and we decided that we would go our separate ways, and I would ship live and he would process. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. And in the process, we kind of went to war.
I know.
And he had the big plant up the hill, and I stayed in our little plant down a couple buildings below, and
right.
We fought over our divers, and we fought over wharfs, and and it was kind of ugly. We drove the price higher, and that made the divers happy, but it made all the other buyers kind of angry. And So we were right in the middle of it, and it was just a brutal time because it was the season was 365 days a year. There were no the only time we got a day off was when the weather was bad, and we looked forward to that with great anticipation. But
so you dive even in the winter, then?
All through the winter. That was the big time in December. Mm-hmm. 24th was typically the biggest day of the season because those urchins that we'd pack on Christmas Eve mm-hmm. till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning would end up in Japan at just the right time for the New Year. And so that was the day we made the most money, and the divers usually too, depending on, you know, and we were usually pretty lucky that day. Was usually a pretty good day, and the worst weather was in January and February, sure. Believe it or not. And anyway, so Mark had his 100 Orientals living in Rockland, Maine, and he took on a couple of other partners, and he did pretty well. And there were, and it was hard for me to compete because I had like 3 or 4 employees, and I had to go. He had the Rockland Fish Pier tied up, so I couldn't buy there. My buyer from Japan came over, moved into a condo at the Samoset, and helped me. I mean, he really helped me a lot. He did everything. And we'd go to Stonington every day mm-hmm. with a truck and a bunch of guys to help us load the truck and buy the urchins and everything else, and we got the urchins we needed up there because there were a lot of boats in Stonington at the time. Unfortunately, a lot of them were playing games, and you know, we'd go down on their boat, climb down on these icy ladders down onto the boats, and almost kill ourselves. And they'd have their urchins laid out there, and we'd crack a few, and oh my God, these are beautiful. And we'd buy them. We'd give them big money. We were paying like $2 a pound for them, which was huge at that point. And then we'd get them back to the plant and get ready to pack them and start dumping them on the table. And, oh, my God, these aren't any good. What happened? Well, they'd put all the bad ones on the bottom and covered them up on top with some really good ones. And they cheated us.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, we figured it out after a while, and things got better, but that was crucial. I mean, we sent these, we had no choice but to send them on to Japan because we'd already paid too much for them, mm-hmm. and they'd be calling and saying, "What are you doing? These stink. These are terrible. We can't use these." I know, sorry. But they understood we were at war and we had to survive, so they kept sending the money, and we kept buying, and so the season typically would end around May, March or April. It was about a 6-7 month season. Thank God we'd get some time off then. Even though the season was still open, they would spawn out, so they were empty. There was no fishing for usually until August or September that point. So we got to recharge our batteries and figure out everything we did wrong and whether we made any money or not. And in those days, we did all right. But
it sounds like it was lucrative enough to keep you going until the next season.
Yeah. And then so around the mid-90s, things started getting a little dicey in Japan. They had a recession, and the Japanese bubble, which was really what this was all built on, started to pop. Mm-hmm. And it hurt the processors more than it hurt me. It kind of helped me because by this point, I was dealing with high-end. I was able to pay a little more than the processors because I had a direct route to these processors in Japan, and I could always pay 20 or 30 cents more than the processors. So I was able to attract the best divers, and they wanted that extra 20 cents, and they would bring me the good urchins because they wanted me to succeed.
Right.
And they considered the processed market to be kind of, you know, the low end. Mm-hmm. They didn't want anything to do with the low end. You know, they wanted to be the man.
The premium suppliers.
Right. And, of course, I played that up as best I could. And it started to work for me really well. And I went to Port Clyde. I went to down to the Damariscotta River to South Bristol, and I lined up buyers down there, and we went down east, certain places where you had to be ahead of the curve to find the new sources of supply that might be good, because they were different everywhere. And it turns out that we learned, you know, the best urchins are in the current, in the rivers and in the places where there's high current. And a lot of these places were like way offshore out to Matinicus. Mm-hmm. And so boats would spend hours just getting out there.
Right.
And spending all day out there. And it was some of the most difficult conditions to dive in, because you're way out there and the it's like a swimming in a washing machine, for heaven's sakes. You know, they're down there and they're trying to hold on with one hand and pick up urchins with the other. And but that's where the good ones were, and they wanted that big money. So there were different strategies on the divers' parts. Some of them preferred to work on volume, make their money on a lot of urchins rather than the guys that I wanted, who didn't get as many, but they were better.
Right.
So I kind of had to pay them more money, you know, just to make it. It wasn't really fair for a guy to bring in a lot of low end and get paid more than a guy who brought in a little bit of good stuff. And that's how I worked it. That's what I wanted, and that's what they wanted to do. I mean, they didn't want to kill themselves.
So what's a good urchin? A bigger one with a lot of roe, or what's the high end?
The high end is actually the ideal urchin's about that size.
So about three inches across.
And that's what they're fishing on nowadays. Nowadays we have a minimum size and a maximum size, so we want to leave the biggest urchins alone, so they'll be the brood stock for future fisheries. And the little ones can still produce spawn before they become legal size. So it took 25 years before this fishery's really being managed the way it's supposed to be. And I say that a lot of that's because the state, they were more concerned with saving the lobster business than they were with making the urchins a sustainable fishery. I don't know if they did it on purpose. They probably get some pressure from the lobster industry, but it could have been managed much, much better than it was. And we have to take some of the blame, because we were the ones that were managing it too. And at first we had no idea. A lot of guys said, well, gee, if we close the season too much, and you know, the Japanese will just go somewhere else. We got to be careful. And I don't really think that was true, but it was an easy sell because everybody wanted to make as much money as they could, of course. Right. So I don't know. I had a good run from like the mid '90s to about 2003, mm-hmm. And at that point, the urchins were getting overfished. The processors were not making a lot of money, and I lost my market at that point to Russian competition that was in the Kuril Islands just north of Hokkaido. So instead of having to pay $1.50 a pound for air freight from Boston, you know, I would send my urchins down on a tractor trailer load just about every day during the good days, and they'd go on a plane and they'd be in Tokyo and then off on to Sapporo from there. So it was an expensive proposition to get them over there. And the Russians could deliver by boat, so they could do it a lot cheaper. And it's a volume game. It's an economy of scale, and the Japanese, you know, they didn't want to give up what they had here, but their customers, the processors, said, we want the volume that these guys can get, and we can buy them cheaper. So all of a sudden, one day, it just ended for me, and I had to decide, well, gee, am I going to have to sell? Am I going to be able to? I wanted to stay in business because I figured the Russians would fish themselves out quickly.
Sure.
But they didn't. I don't know what happened. They had more urchins than I thought they did, I guess. So I wanted to keep my divers, of course. I mean, they were all independent contractors, but they were all selling to me, and they wanted to sell to me. And yet, once I lost that live market and I couldn't pay that extra 20 or 30 cents, I became just another market.
Yeah.
And all the processors that I'd competed with, they didn't really want to do me any favors. In fact, they were kind of hoping I'd fail. And eventually, one of them didn't pay me a lot of money in 2009. And I stopped buying urchins in 2009. The fishery's still in existence. It's at the peak of it, we were harvesting about 60 million pounds a season. And now they're down to like 3 million pounds. And it's...
That's an incredible drop.
It is. And they're not looking like they're coming back. We've learned a lot in the 25 years that we've been doing it. And one of the things we learned is that, the kelp all grew back because there weren't any urchins to eat it. So that's good for lobstermen because baby urchins love to hide in kelp beds. I mean, baby lobsters, excuse me, love to hide in kelp beds. And so the lobster industry's happy. They've had record catches ever since we cleaned up the urchins, and they know it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also the idea that there aren't many ground fish around. Ground fish are predators on lobsters, too, and that's part of the equation. But they all know that the fact that the urchins are gone is good for their business. And in fact, it's a little too good because there's so many lobsters out there now that, you know, the prices in the tank,
and
there's a glut,
right,
basically. And in Canada, the same thing on a smaller scale happened in Canada. We bought a lot of urchins from Canada in certain places, and they had a similar setup up there, although they never had the numbers that we had. At one time, there were 3,000 urchin divers working the coast of Maine.
That's incredible.
And so, as you can imagine, there were a lot of pretty interesting stories that, I mean, we never had any great white sharks like they did in California. I mean, a number of divers got eaten by great white sharks out in California, but there were a lot of other things that went on. I mean, guys would come in and talk about the seals that attacked them, and, you know, they'd see things. They didn't know whether a shark or a seal until they'd often like swallow their regulator or spit it out.
Right.
And oftentimes the boat, the big boats that had like two or three divers on them usually took a couple of skiffs along with them. So the mothership would anchor somewhere and the divers would jump in the water, and then the guys in the skiffs would run out to wherever they ended up and pick up the bags and bring them back to the big boat. And do that all day, and, you know, by the end of the day, they'd have 100 totes on board, and what's that? Like, you know, that's like 8,000 pounds of urchins.
Lord.
Get back to the wharf, and, I mean, there'd just be incredible amounts of product sitting on, like, the Rockland Fish Pier. I mean, one day I spent $100,000 in an afternoon on the Rockland Fish Pier.
That's amazing.
I know. And I guess my best year was in like 1998. I shipped almost 2 million pounds to Japan over like a 6-month period, and I made a lot of money.
It's an incredible volume.
But it just didn't last. We couldn't sustain it. And the problem was this guy in Portland, who was one of the bigger processors, he developed a product that really, it was brilliant, and yet it kind of was the death knell for the whole industry, because it expanded the market so much that all these new people got involved. There were processing plants opening down in New York City and Boston area, Gloucester, New Bedford, and here in Maine. There must have been 20 or 30 processing plants, and they all needed 500 totes every day. So it got to the point where, you know, they just sent people out to buy, and they started buying junk. They bought bad urchins because they just had to have the volume to keep their workers busy.
Right.
And that just kind of created a really bad situation. Quality standards went down. Prices were higher than they should have been because everybody was trying to fill their orders, and a lot of them didn't last very long. And it created a bad feeling between the divers and the buyers, because everybody was cheating everybody else. And, well, you got me yesterday, I'll get you today. You know, but like they were, like I was saying, they would, you know, and they became very good at hiding bad urchins under good urchins. And, you know, you didn't have time to really look through. I was the only one that could take urchins at the wharf in Rockland and put them on my truck without giving them a weight or a price until the next day. That gave me the opportunity to dump them on my tables and find out what I really had. And they let me do that because I was paying the most money and they trusted me.
Right.
And trusting any seafood buyer is a rare thing in this business anywhere in the world. You don't find people putting product on their truck without paying for it in advance. So that was the thing that I was most proud of in my career as an urchin buyer. And so the other guys, they just kind of disappeared. I mean, that plastic tray, which was innovative in Japan because it drove the price of it, it created a whole new market with Japanese middle class people. Uni, which is what they call urchin roe in Japan, had always been a rich man's food at the most expensive sushi bars. He was able to ship it over there in these plastic trays and price it so that middle class consumers could buy it at department stores in Japan. And it was a great thing, and yet it really hurt the established urchin people in Japan. It drove their price down, and so he was kind of their bad guy. And the funny thing is, he's the only one left, and he has survived all of this. He now has a domestic market in this country, and the Cambodian people who kind of took over what I do, and they are the big buyers now. They haven't been able to make money selling to Japan because they're paying too much for their urchins. So they've kind of put themselves out of business, and Mr. Tamaki has it all to himself now. And I have to tip my hat to him for that. He's the survivor. And he's also diversified into other products. He's doing sea cucumbers, and that's big in China. So the rest of us, we weren't able to parlay that into another product. And I gotta give him a lot of credit for the way he's been able to diversify and survive. And I'm out of business. I'm looking for the next big thing. And I've been working on this green crab situation, which is it reminds me so much of when we started doing urchins, because not only are they affecting the clam business and the other shellfish businesses, they're now affecting the lobster business. They're interacting with lobsters, and a little tiny green crab can kill a lobster like that real easily.
I've heard they're very super invasive.
Super predators, and they're everywhere, and they are a threat to the main fishery in general, everything. So I'm hoping I'm going to be able to come up with a solution for that. I haven't got it yet, but
can you eat the green crab, or is it more?
They have a little. They're small.
Right.
They don't have much meat in them. So from a processor standpoint, nobody wants to process them because there's no money in it.
Right.
And but there may be a place, an industrial type of use for it. I think somebody will probably figure it out eventually. And climate change is bringing opportunity. There are things coming up from the south that might create new fisheries here in Maine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm kind of tired of the seafood business, but it's what I know. What I have left is I still have a good reputation. I still have a network of people that I talk to and that would do business with me again if I had the right markets. And I hate to say it, but with the situation in Fukushima, they may want something from Maine again, and we may have urchins at some point.
Right.
It's hard to say how urchins are going to react to these warming waters. It's probably not going to be good for them because they're a cold water species. But you never know.
It sounds like you've positioned yourself pretty well, though, for what comes next.
Hopefully, but I don't know. I may end up doing something completely different. I don't know. It's at my age, it's hard to see doing something like that again. It's just a young man's game, you know.
What did you love most about the seafood business? Can you talk about
it? Yeah, I mean, it was the independence. Of course, the money was good. It was like every day was exciting. It wasn't like being in the insurance business where everything was the same every day.
Right.
And just every night, I had to go to work at like midnight. I was working like 20 hours a day. Go in at midnight, pack. We had to have him on the truck at like 8 o'clock in the morning, so he'd be in Boston by noon to catch the plane in New York. Most of the planes actually left from New York, so they'd have to truck him on to New York. And then just do it again the next day. And it was exhausting, but I had a good crew, and it was very fulfilling. It really was.
You weren't stuck behind a desk.
I mean, and the thing I hate the most is that everybody looks at the urchin fishery now and says, well, that's an example of how not to do things. And in a way, it was. But they don't understand that we really made things better for the for the lobster business. And, you know, I don't really have a problem with that, because the lobster fishery is more important to the state of Maine than the urchin fishery probably ever could have been. And maybe we sacrifice one fishery for another, and that's okay. I'm cool with that. Mm-hmm. But don't call us rapists and pillagers, for heaven's sakes. And that's what a lot of people think about when they think of urchins. And, you know, the Elver business now is in the news a lot. It's very similar, except that they're so tiny, and you know, they've got a 5-gallon bucket worth $100,000 instead of a truck full of urchins that was worth $100,000. But you know, that's the price is down on those this year. That they had their 2 years of glory. I don't see that sustaining either. Yeah, the memories are great. I wish I didn't have this big check for $352,000 that I can't cash. And there's a picture of me with the commissioner and the governor when we first signed the first urchin regulations.
And do you want to just? We can go a couple more minutes if you want to talk about that picture a little bit.
Well, there's nothing really to say except that you know, we waited too long to put the regulations on. If we'd done that right at the beginning, I used to take people down to Portland, some Japanese buyers down to Portland, look at the plants down there, and we'd go out on the wharf, and there'd be thousands of trays of gurry.
What is that?
When a gurry is like all the waste, and there'd be all these small urchins in there that should have been dumped back in the water, but at that time the divers were just raking up everything, and we'd cull them in the plant. So at the end of the pack out, you know, we'd have all these baby urchins, and I always tried to get them back in the water right away, and still a lot of them wouldn't survive in the cold weather and everything, but millions of babies died on the wharf and in the plants in those days, and we should have known better than that. So, you know, in some ways we kind of got what we deserved, I guess. But I tried to write a book about it once, but nobody wanted to publish it. And it's just a part of history, and yet it was, at that time, it was a huge thing for people that needed work, and a lot of these guys are still doing it. There's about 400 left, and they now can only harvest 7 totes in 1 day, and they thought that was going to be terrible, but they like it now because they can be in at 11 o'clock in the morning and go do something else and get a good price for their urchins, because when you can only get that many, and we should have figured this out long ago, you're going to get the best ones you can.
Right.
To get the best price you can. That's what I did, but for some reason, a lot of other people didn't figure that out.
Thank you for sharing.
Yes, thank you so much.
I don't really know. I didn't get to a lot of it, but that's the highlights. And
well, you definitely shed some light on a fishery that not a lot of people have talked about. It's all focused on lobsters. So thank you
You're
so
welcome.
Much for sharing.
You're welcome. It was fun.